National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. More than 7 million children in America have a parent under some form of correctional supervision. Mothers in particular are often incarcerated far away from their children with no easy opportunities for visitation. Author and journalist Sue Stauffacher recognized the problem and wrote Harry Sue, an exquisite novel for young readers whose heroine is the only child of convicted felons who wants nothing more than to join them in prison. Sue's work has led her to organize writing workshops for women who've been separated from their children, and she'll tell us about her experiences and her new novel today on Smart City. Also with us is best-selling author Joel Barker. His latest book is Five Regions of the Future, Preparing the Business for Tomorrow's Technology Revolution. We'll talk to Sue Stauffacher and Joel Barker today on Smart City, right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Sue Stauffacher is author of Harry Sue, a young reader's book about a cast-off child of two convicted felons. Sue is a journalist and has been writing a children's book review column for 10 years. She also conducts writing workshops with women who have been separated from their children due to imprisonment or neglect as a result of their drug use. Sue's home is in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Harriet Susan Klotkin is not the sort of name you'd imagine for the First Lady President of the United States. That's just fine by me, as I never had designs on running for political office, but planned instead on following in the family tradition, a career of incarceration. As soon as I was old enough, I was headed for the joint. First, I had to have the required 14 to 16 years of rotten childhood. So far, I had only served 11 years and change. Time was running out on my becoming a juvenile delinquent. The really impressive cons started their rap sheets by 9 or 10. Unfortunately, I had a heart condition that needed fixing before I could begin a serious crime spree. Yes, Fish, my heart was as lumpy and soft as a rotten tomato. I couldn't stand to see things hurt, especially anything weak and defenseless. Watching Jolly Roger and his road dogs pull the legs off a spider made me grind my teeth down worse than if I slept with a mouthful of sandpaper. When those boys clicked the little kids on the bus, I had to sit on my hands just to keep from breaking theirs. In the joint where I was headed, I'd need a heart filled with cement and covered in riveted steel. I was working on it, but so far, I wasn't making much progress.
Sue, you grab your readers from the very beginning of this book. Do you think the sentiment expressed there, I'm following in the family tradition a career of incarceration, do you think that's typical of children of incarcerated parents?
A lot of children of incarcerated parents are left on their own to figure out their solutions. So this is one way that actually I know for certain some kids do fantasize about, and that is, if mom can't come home to me, I'm going to go and live with her there.
You use that expression, clicked, and you have a Harry Sue's joint jive glossary,
right,
in the book. It's a really, really quick tip-off to the fact that this is not your usual children's story. In the book, you set up this comparison between Harry Sue's life and The Wizard of Oz, the last book that Harry Sue's mother read her before leaving for prison. Describe briefly the story of Harry Sue.
Well, one of the reasons I did want to set up that comparison between The Wizard of Oz is to explore, both for adults and for my child readers, this idea that children at risk, children in poverty, children who have situations like Harry Sue's often have an interior life that's very different than the life they show to other people. In Harry Sue, she uses the comparison between the movie of The Wizard of Oz and the book of The Wizard of Oz to try to describe how it feels. If you haven't read the book, you don't know the real story. And don't think you know my real story, Harry Sue's, because you don't. And what is Harry Sue's story? I guess that's a good question. It's basically the story of a girl who's trying to grapple with the emotional and the practical consequences of being a child whose parents have been sent away to prison. So that means, where does she live? How does she explain to other people what's going on in her life? How does she deal with her sadness and her feelings of shame?
How did you come to write this story? How did you get interested and knowledgeable about children of incarcerated parents?
Well, I've worked with kids who are at risk, and one of the things, it's kind of strange. There are two stories. First, I just wrote the story. It just came out of me, and it grew out of experiences that I've had over the last dozen years mentoring and working with kids who are at risk. But then afterwards, because I'm also a journalist, I decided to really research the issue, and I discovered that, according to the Women's Prison Association, since 1980, the number of women in prison has increased almost 600%. And this is mostly due, according to them, to stiffer and mandatory drug sentencing laws. So we're finding that a lot more women are in prison, and that means a lot more moms. Often they're single heads of households, so you're breaking up a whole family. So this is an issue that maybe has been under the radar screen, but is going to be busting out pretty soon.
What typically happens to their children while they are incarcerated?
Well, a number of things can happen. They actually, a very small percentage go into foster care, but for the most part, these kids are put with relatives, and often the relatives are angry at the person who went to prison for, quote-unquote, saddling them with another mouth to feed, and so they find themselves in a situation where they're not wanted, and no one is keeping track of them. There are no programs to look after what's happened to these kids, especially if they're with relatives. So this also means that they're often disconnected from their parent entirely, because especially if it's a woman, since there are fewer women prisoners, they go farther away, and often the caregivers are angry and they don't want to spend the money and the time to take the child to visit their parent in prison. And so not only has the child been put in a place where they're not wanted, they've lost touch. They've been torn away from the person who may have loved and cared for them better.
You have met many of these women now because you have conducted a number of writing workshops for female prisoners.
I have, yes.
Tell me what you typically find, if there is such a thing as typical, about their situations. In other words, perhaps you've made a judgment about whether children, in fact, should be having contact with their mothers who are incarcerated.
I think the answer to should they have contact is unequivocally yes, and that's from the research that I've done, not from me personally. It was very difficult for me as a mother myself to understand why a woman who was in prison would not contact her child on the outs, as Harry Sue would say. I just had to know what it was that was motivating these women. So I found a number of women willing to work with me in writing workshops and tell me why it is that they choose not to connect to their kids. And would you like me to read one of the letters that was written as a result of this?
Yes, please.
It does sort of explain some of the issues that are happening, but more generally, we got together, we write poetry and letters, and many of these women have been separated from their kids for a number of years and haven't contacted them, and it's because they feel very ashamed of what they've done, and they feel that perhaps their children would be better off without them. And this is what this particular woman wrote. She writes, "My dearest, my precious, my beautiful daughters. Hello, sweethearts. Yes, it's me. I'm still alive, even though the break in my heart branches out and tears holes in my soul each and every day. Every second since the last time I saw my two beautiful daughters has been filled with agony. There truly is no possible way to put into words how very precious you both are to me. I am so mad at myself. In fact, at times I hate myself for letting you down. I didn't walk away from you. I was shoved away long before either of you were ever born by becoming a drug addict. On the days where you were born, I swore with every fiber of my being that I would always love you and always protect you and see to it that you would never hate me the way I hated my mother and father for all the mean, nasty things they did to me and the way they made me feel worthless. I know a lot of people tried to make you believe that you two didn't mean as much to me as drugs. They were so wrong. Please don't believe that. I did drugs to keep you from hurting deep inside my heart. Both of you meant everything and still mean everything to me. Please don't think for a fraction of a second that it's your fault or that I didn't want you, because that is not true. It was the drugs. I didn't do drugs, baby girls. They did me. And since you have been gone, not one day has passed that I didn't think of you, miss you, or wonder if you were all right. I'm clean now, and I'm going to stay clean 1 minute at a time. I look forward to the day you come home. Please forgive me. You can go to any courthouse and find me. Just tell them to look it up. It's in the paperwork from the court. The ones that took you away, they have to tell you. Love you with all my soul. Your mother, Jodalyn Billington.
As you read the product of your writing workshops, do you or others, other professionals, for instance, think about what these women are writing and what they can learn from what they're writing? I mean, this notion of, I didn't do drugs, the drugs did me. I'm not a drug counselor, so I have
right.
I really have no idea of the appropriateness of that statement for someone trying to get off and stay off drugs. But I'm just wondering if there's a sort of a second level of interpretation that the product of your writing workshop gets.
One of the things that the writing workshop showed me, and the research shows me too, is that the vast majority of these women have been physically and or sexually abused and are often in very bad relationships when they get into trouble with the law. They are, by and large, drug addicts, and the way that our nation has chosen to deal with the problem, which is growing exponentially, particularly now with the rise of crystal methamphetamine use, is to incarcerate them. It doesn't seem an extremely practical solution to do that, because, number one, just incarcerating them does not help them deal with their addiction per se, especially when they're back out in society. And also, what it's doing is creating a whole huge new pool with all these children of potential juvenile delinquents and criminals. The likelihood of children whose parents are under correctional sanction to become involved with the court system is just enormous. They have tons of problems. And so this just doesn't seem like a real smart way to deal with it.
What is a smart way to deal with it, in your opinion, Sue?
Well, one of the things is we really need to try to maintain that connection between women and their children. And there are a few programs that I did learn about, and one is the Girl Scouts Beyond Bars program. And there are often local, for example, here in Grand Rapids, our criminal justice chaplaincy has a program that drives children to prison to visit their parents. So one is just maintain the bond, help parents in prison maintain the bond with their children. They know that those who have family ties and connections are less likely to reoffend. So that's a good thing overall. But what we're finding that's competing with is that federal money is being cut, and so a lot of these programs are considered frills, and they're being cut out. And then as far as women addicts, I'm not sure what the best way is, but addiction is something you need to recover from, so it needs to be treated as an illness.
Have you seen children get these letters, get these poems that their mothers have written?
No, I haven't. The women that I've been working with are separated from their kids at the time that they're writing them, so I haven't. But what I'm hoping is that if children who have parents who are incarcerated read these on the internet, they will see that there's just everybody's saying the same thing. I'm sorry. I miss you. I love you. I can't wait to come back to you.
When you're conducting these writing workshops, Sue, I'm curious, is basic literacy a barrier?
I thought it would be, to be honest with you, but I was, and I've been told that there is a problem with low-level literacy, but to be honest with you, I found them to be very passionate, articulate, and I didn't do a whole lot of editing. One of the things I found surprising was that some of the women really had problems with drugs all their lives, but other women were from the middle class. You know, this is not something that you can attach to a particular socioeconomic level or skin color or anything. It's a completely mixed bag.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Sue Stoffaker. She is author of Harry Sue, a book about a cast-off child of two convicted felons. Tell me why the women participate in the writing workshops. I take it you provide these either in prisons or in halfway houses?
Right. I was working in what could be considered a halfway house. It's a treatment center, like a dormitory-style treatment center, where the women live. And if their children are very young, babies or infants, their children can be on site with them. But other than that, they have to be separated. Why do the women participate? I think once they feel like this is a goodwill effort, they are very anxious to do things to help make up for the crimes that they've committed and the people that they've hurt. They really want to express, and I told them that I felt this might help others who were in their same situation, and they're very anxious. I mean, I came away very impressed by how hard they wanted to work to make things better.
Harry Sue is written for what age reader?
I would say 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. That's the ages that I'm getting the most response from. Mm-hmm. It has such sophisticated themes in it, and by sophisticated, I just mean, you know, really things to really think about. It can be very interesting to older middle school students, but she is 11 years old. So I'm trying to draw in all the avid readers and just give them a very interesting story. But I'm also trying to talk to a specific subset of kids, some of those, you know, 7 million kids whose parents are incarcerated or under correctional sanctions. Mm-hmm. So the only way they're going to get the book is if it gets into the schools, because many of the children I work with do not even have a public library card. Their school library is just about the only place they might encounter a book like Harry Sue.
I want to go back to the pieces that are posted on the website from the women uh-huh. who have been in your workshops. Many of them have the theme, what I have lost and what I've found. Mm-hmm. Did you provide that theme?
I did, because I think when I was asking for permission to print these, a number of women handed me back the permission slip and said, I'm not a writer, so I'm going to opt out. And I said to them, just hold on a minute. And, you know, we were able to determine that actually when you have something to say, you are a writer. And so one of the ways that I do that, because I've been a writing teacher for a long time, is just to provide them with a bit of a structure so it's not so scary, just a blank page. And we read some poems from Naomi Shihab Nye's collection, What I Have Lost. So they were thinking about that.
One of the earlier books you wrote, Donut Head, mm-hmm. is used in classrooms to encourage virtuous behavior. Do you write your books with a message in mind, or does the message simply emerge from the story you've told?
That's such a good question. I can never write with a sort of an overarching message, because I think that's too didactic. But my life really has been an exploration of how adults can affect the lives of children who are not their own. So that always works its way into my books. And I'm a quirky person, so I have quirky characters. And I think I just have an optimistic view of life, and in my opinion, literature needs to inspire young people and encourage them. So even though some crazy things happen and some sad things happen in my books, I think ultimately they're uplifting. So those themes you'll see repeated in all the stories, even the biographical books that I have coming out. I look for those stories in real life too.
What's next for you?
I want to work with hopefully Harry Sue and try as hard as I can to bring it to these alternate populations we were talking about. I like to think of myself as speaking in sort of to try to give kids a blueprint to get out of the problems that they're in. A lot of the children that I work with don't see any way out. And for me, literature was such a way to open up the possibilities of my life. I'm hoping that I can do that for children. I have a sequel coming out to Donut Head, and I have some biographical works coming out, a story from the life of Bessie Smith, and also from the life of Althea Gibson.
Let me ask you this. What are the trends among children today in terms of reading? I think all of us are fearful that there will be a time when no one will pick up a book, and yet, on the other hand, we have these mega bookstores, and it seems like they're on every corner. So are people, in fact, particularly children, are children reading more today?
Well, I give you this opinion not just as a children's book author, but as a person who has reviewed children's books for the last 12 years, so I feel comfortable giving you an overview. And I will tell you, since I'm the mother of two boys, 12 and 14, that children are not reading as much as they used to. The competition is incredibly fierce. I'm trying to respond to that as an author. Not all my books will be like this, but Harry Sue is very fast-paced. It's very visual, and I'm trying to be a modern writer to modern readers. The National Endowment of the Arts released that survey last summer about the decline of literary reading in America, and it's true. It is very much true, but I also think literacy is going to change, and I think graphic novels will become a bigger part of our literate lives. And the way we move, text and visuals will be more married, I think, in children's literature.
Is that an easy concept for you to grasp as an author?
That's an excellent question. I have been exploring it myself because I want people to be literate and to think, and especially the kids I work with who are poor, I want them to be able to join in a democratic society. You have to be able to read to do that. So I have begun a series of comics for kids who are low-level literacy, but they're very sophisticated. So you could be in fifth grade, and it's a simple comic. It's available free on my website. So anybody who's working with children who are having a tough time getting into reading can download it. And so I've written the scripts for these comics, so I'm playing with the ideas myself. I would someday like to write a graphic novel. It's sort of like writing a screenplay, so you need to change the way you convey information, but it's still telling a story.
I want to thank you so much for being our guest on Smart City and reading for us today. Thanks, Sue.
Oh, you're welcome.
Sue Stoffaker is author of Harry Sue. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about gay rights in Tampa. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk to Joel Barker about his new book, Five Regions of the Future, Preparing Your Business for Tomorrow's Technology. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he gives us urban insights from around the country. Otis, the debate about gay rights in this country has been divisive, but probably no place more than at a local level when a mayor and a city council and a local citizenry then have to tackle the issue and competing factions in a town. And one city in particular recently has confronted the situation. That's Tampa.
Yeah, and this is one of those things where they didn't have to get into this, but they did, because obviously emotional issues like this resonate with certain folks. Now, what will seem very strange about this is, of course, that at the local level, there really isn't a lot that cities can do, particularly about the sort of really hot-button issue, which is gay marriage, because those are decisions that are made at the state and federal level. But politicians really can't help wading into this. And we saw it a year ago with the mayor of San Francisco who weighed in on it. And now we're seeing it from the opposite direction down in the Tampa area. There's a county commissioner named Rhonda Storms who made a motion at a recent county commission meeting that the county government abstain from acknowledging, promoting, or participating in gay pride recognition and events. Now, gay pride is it's now sort of a national phenomenon, but it's an annual, usually week or sometimes a month of activities which are affirming of gay rights. These things are pretty common. They have one in Tampa. And so this county commissioner sort of injected herself into this otherwise fairly routine festival by saying that the county would not participate in this. And strangely enough, this motion got passed. Now, technically, all it means is that you can't put displays about upcoming gay pride events in county buildings, including libraries. But truly, this is one of those things, which is to send a message that gays aren't particularly welcome. Now, this threw folks in Tampa into a panic because the mayor and the business community there has tried to be extremely welcoming to gays, to cultural, creative types, and display a certain urbanity about the city of Tampa. So they let it be known immediately that while Hillsborough County did include the city of Tampa, the county commission did not speak for the city itself. And the city has an ordinance which protects gays from discrimination, and the business community is very concerned that this is going to be bad for business.
Do you see this going anywhere in Tampa and Hillsborough County, or do you think we've heard the end of it?
The religious right community in the area has said that it wants to target that anti-discrimination ordinance that the city has that protects gays. They want to have a referendum on that and try to repeal it.
I guess we've not heard the end of it. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Joel Barker is co-author of Five Regions of the Future, Preparing Your Business for Tomorrow's Technology Revolution. He is an international speaker and global expert on technologies, paradigm shifts, and business futures. His earlier book, Future Edge, was a bestseller. Joel, the five regions referred to in the title of your new book are not geographic regions. They refer instead to five sets of technology and the future they are creating. What are the five?
The five regions that we've identified, Carol, are super tech, limits tech, local tech, nature tech, and human tech. And those are just short forms for, if we're going to say it truly, it's a super technicology. That is, it's a technological ecosystem in which the technologies come together in a coherent fashion so that they make sense.
Help us picture what you mean by a technicology.
Okay. If you think about an ecosystem, what you think about when you think about an ecosystem, there's large animals and small animals, and there are certain resources that those animals use, and they, of course, the animals are actually resources for one another. In other words, they prey on one another, and they collaborate with one another. And what Dr. Scott Erickson and I have identified in our book, Five Regions of the Future, is that technologies are doing that same kind of coming together to create a coherent package and literally collaborating with one another, building on one another, predating on one another, and so that you have in technology something that looks very much like an ecosystem, and that's why we call that a technological ecosystem. So let me just illustrate very quickly. All ecosystems have to have an energy base, and each of these technologies has an energy base. For instance, the limits tech region of the future gets its energy by being extremely efficient with what is available. So efficiency is kind of the code word for limits tech. What that means is you build technologies that use very little energy. Well, once you get started on that road, they reinforce one another. And I'll give you an example. There is an insulation called aerogels. It is basically made out of almost nothing. It sounds kind of funny, but it's little bubbles with very thin edges that are solid. Light can pass through it. Well, at its most efficient, 1 inch of aerogel is like R40. That means if you put your house in it, you could almost heat your house with a candle. It's so efficient. But in Minnesota, you would put up a south wall of aerogel, that is a piece of glass, aerogel in between it, piece of glass behind it. And during the winter, the sun shining in Minnesota when it's 20 below will dump so much heat into the house that you're actually heating the house through that window. And because the aerogel insulation is so efficient, the heat doesn't escape back out. Well, if you think about that as an ecosystem, that everything you're looking for is to save energy, there's a whole bunch of technology you would never build. For instance, you would never build an SUV. So that once you start the premise of how the technological ecosystem starts, that premise, a set of values really, drives the way the technologies evolve and drives the way they interact.
And you say there are four values questions that characterize each of the ecosystems.
Yes, each of the regions has, we found four rules is all you need to characterize each of the regions. One is a rule about kind of wealth, you know, what is wealth and how much should you have, kind of like. Second one is the role of science and technology in that region, how you use science and technology. The third, and this is like one of the really key ones, is the relationship of that region to nature. Very important value rule for each region. And then the last one is kind of the nature of what is the work of human beings in each of these regions. And each region has a different set of rules.
Now, with this notion of these five regions, Joel, are you setting up a choice for an individual, a society, or do they all coexist? And if that's the case, what sense does it make, or what purpose does it serve?
Well, they all coexist because these choices start at the individual level and then form communities. And, of course, your interest has been on cities, and certainly cities are dramatically influenced by the five regions of the future, all the way up into nations. When you ask the question, what's the value of this discussion, it reminds me of a story that we all know of, in which we have all been taught, I think, as children, that the Eskimos had many words for snow, like 30 or 35 words for snow. And the question was, why would you have that many words? And the answer is, because you can discriminate better. If you know what snow you have, you know what you can do with it. What we're trying to do with Five Regions of the Future is create a new lexicon for discussing technology in our society, because right now, most people basically get excited about, well, you talk about high technology, oh, that's high technology, or sometimes you hear biotechnology, or every once in a while you hear information technology. Those labels are not very useful for talking about our future. And so what we've tried to do is create what we call applications labels for technology. So if I were to, once we understand what limits tech is, if I said I have a new piece of limits technology, you would actually know right away why that was important and how it would be used, even though you wouldn't know specifically what the technology was.
The subtitle of your book is Preparing Your Business for Tomorrow's Technology Revolution, but as you said, we primarily talk here about cities.
Right.
Can you see a city banking its future on one of these regions?
Cities certainly are dramatically influenced by the shape and the force of the technologies they use. Let me give you an example. Have you ever heard of a city called Curitiba out of Brazil?
I have. In fact, we've talked to its former mayor.
Yeah, he's a cool guy, isn't he?
He is.
Architect.
Jaime Lerner,
and,
yes.
Oh, what a wonderful human being. But if you think about Curitiba as a city, they made some technology decisions, their bus subway system, for instance, that shaped that city dramatically and actually makes it a significant local tech city. So cities are profoundly affected by this. Let me give you a second example. I'm sure you have had discussions on the future of water in cities.
Yes, we have.
Well, a super techer would say, no problem here. What we'll do is we'll desalinate the ocean and get you all the water you want, because super techers are all about superabundance, lots of everything for everyone. A limits techer would say, let's stop using drinking water to flush toilets. Well, can you see how different the technology is between those two different regions and the values that they hold?
Certainly. And what I want to push on a little bit here, Joel, is at what level those decisions get made. I mean, at the level you're talking about, I would see it more as a municipal decision, again, rather than an individual decision. In other words, if a municipality makes a big bet on one of these regions, one approach to technology, do you think it has benefits not only in terms of, you know, creating systems that then individuals can plug into very easily and you don't have to make the decision 500,000 times, you can make it once at the municipal level, but perhaps more importantly, by betting on one of these regions, one of these technology approaches, you begin to build expertise that then is exportable.
I think you're right onto it. Number one, municipalities carry, I think, the highest leverage for any of these decisions. I am a great fan of Jane Jacobs, and she has always said that the wealth of the world is generated in the cities. Well, so are the innovations. And so if we work at that city level, at that municipal level, that is the place to make these decisions, because it's a large enough group of people that you can actually get mass production value in what you're going to do. So you produce enough so that you can really keep the cost down. Number two, you're absolutely right. You become expert in something which is exportable to the rest of the world who wants to follow the region that you're in. And what Scott and I see around the world is that you can actually see these various regions beginning to blossom. SuperTech, of course, as we mentioned in the book, was around, it was the dominant region for all of the 20th century. So there's a lot of SuperTech around. But what's fascinating right now is to see these other technologies begin to move into the fore. General Electric is now talking about eco-imagination, and they're showing windmills as a power generation alternative. That's a big deal because for some municipalities, they ought to have that. In fact, the University of Minnesota Morris campus has put up a windmill to power a good portion of that entire university. So what you can see is groups of people making a decision, made the investment. Now, in fact, they begin to reap their energy in a fundamentally different way than they did before. And as you pointed out, that begins to cascade as other people look at it to copy it, to see what happens from it. And it begins to grow.
You've been hinting at it, but let me give you a chance to talk about each of these regions. Let's start with SuperTech. You've mentioned it. You said it dominated the 20th century. It gets a lot of media coverage. It's sort of the sexy part of this, I guess. Describe the SuperTech ecosystem.
Sure. SuperTechnology has a couple of very interesting rules. Number one, it believes that it can produce more than enough of everything for everyone worldwide. And so that's why its key theme is superabundance. It likes to solve every problem it faces with science. So there are no political solutions. There are no human-to-human discussions. We just use science and technology to solve the whole problem. Third, this is especially important for SuperTech. SuperTech basically says about nature, it's okay how you've done it till now, nature, but we're actually smarter than you are. From here on out, we will build artificial things that actually work better than natural things. And then the last kind of operating rule for SuperTech is human beings don't like to work. So we want as much leisure time as possible to basically enjoy ourselves, play games, travel, but certainly don't do work. And that's one of the reasons that robots are just a very large technology in the SuperTech region, because the robots are going to do the work, so we don't have to.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Joel Barker. He's co-author with Scott Erickson of a new book, Five Regions of the Future, Preparing Your Business for Tomorrow's Technology Revolution. We were talking about SuperTech. Let's go to the second region, Limits Tech. Is that the opposite of SuperTech?
Well, let's look at the rules and see if it is. Rule number one, where superabundance was the theme for SuperTech, in Limits Tech, it's scarcity is just around the corner. And what Limits Techers mean by that is all the easy-to-be-gotten stuff has been gotten. You can't go into a field in Pennsylvania, stick a stick in the ground, and expect oil to spurt out anymore. Instead, we're sitting there in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, they basically lower a tube 5,000 feet down through the water to get to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico and begin drilling then. You can see the difference. So what the Limits Techers say is the easy-to-be-gotten stuff has been gotten, therefore we should treat whatever else we have with much greater care and much greater efficiency. And efficiency is just a really key word for Limits Techers. They want to use stuff efficiently. Second rule, science and technology has been a Faustian contract up to now, and what they mean by that is we've gotten lots of short-term benefits, but the long-term downside of some of the science and technology is starting to roll out on us, and one of those examples would be global warming. Cars were great. Burning up that CO2 was really good to give us transportation, but now there's a consequence to be paid for that. And it's one of the things that you'll see with Limits Techers is they think about the system, the whole system, and they think long term. Third rule, you don't mess with Mother Nature. Mother Nature knows best. Limits Techers take a simple assumption. Mother Nature's been working for a billion years figuring out things. She's probably got a pretty robust solution. Look to her solution. Don't mess with her, basically. And then the last rule for Limits Tech is we're going to have to work very hard. The next 1,000 years for human beings is the crucial time, and it's going to be hard work at least for the next 100 years to guarantee the next 1,000 years. But by the way, that may sound a little gloomy, but they're not at all. They have a wonderful future if you take a look at some of the technologies that they have developed.
But I think you're right in that this whole notion has been hard to sell because it suggests that we're going to have to give up things that we don't want to give up.
And that's actually false. Again, look at energy. Amory Lovins did a study back in the 70s that showed that probably 30 to 35% of all the electricity that America uses is wasted. So if you just begin to gather that through more efficient use of illumination, for instance, LED lights and fluorescent lights instead of incandescent lights, all of a sudden you are reducing your energy needs, but you have exactly the same amount of light on your table as you had before. So that is part of the media dilemma, is limits tech is perceived as, oh, you have to give up something. No, you have to do it differently.
Well, perhaps it's the naming, limits. We're not real fond of limits. Let's talk for a minute about local tech, which you hinted at earlier. Describe local tech.
Local tech is, again, kind of tangential to the first two. First rule, there is enough in the world for everyone. Number two, science and technology is a good thing as long as it understands scale and locality. That is, gigantic machines are not necessarily the way to go. And number two, the science should be applied to the local situation. And I'll illustrate that with energy here in just a minute. Third, we are the shepherds of nature. So one said, by nature. The second one said, boy, just don't mess with Mother Nature. Local tech are saying, no, we're shepherds. And in that sense, we protect, but we harvest. And then last, and this comes right out of Schumacher's book, you need to work. It's not about economics. It's about to be fully human. To find out who you really are, you must do good work in life. So even if you're a billionaire, you still have to work if you want to grow to your full potential. Now, to illustrate this science locality thing, we were talking energy, and it's just a really good theme to run through here. In local tech, where the sun shines, you gather the sunlight, solar shingles, for instance. Where the wind blows, you gather the wind. But there are a lot of places in the world where the wind doesn't blow. Where the waves come in, you do wave power. Where you're lucky enough to have geothermal access, like Hawaii and Iceland, you tap that. In other words, the locale determines how and what you use to generate your energy. So you can see the contrast between the three, just as if you look at the energy.
Are there any communities seriously exploring local tech as an economic development or replacement strategy? You mentioned the University of Minnesota at Morris using windmills. Do you see this happening in the U.S. on any municipal level?
I think what's happening right now is more and more communities are beginning to address this. Let's go to Tampa for a minute and just think about Tampa. They have got a very significant water issue, saltwater incursion. Had the hurricanes not come last year, they were really facing some very difficult decisions about the use of their fresh water. Well, thanks for the hurricanes, they got their aquifers filled up. But they should really be thinking local tech. What could we do here to not draw down those aquifers nearly as fast? What would be appropriate for this locale? And I think what we're seeing is those kinds of conversations are starting to become more and more significant, because the alternative, which is super tech, can be very, very expensive. And I think we're going to have a cost-benefit trade-off here that's going to start to make limits tech and local tech and even nature tech start looking very reasonable compared to just carrying on with super tech without questioning it.
There are two regions we haven't talked about. You just mentioned one, nature tech, and then there is human tech. Give us a quick understanding of those two.
Yeah. Well, nature tech basically believes that Mother Nature actually has provided all that we need already. Second thing nature tech believes is that science and technology's job then is to discover those things that are out there rather than to try and keep inventing things that aren't, quotes, natural. Third thing, our relationship with nature is a partner. We're basically co-partner because we have the capacity to manipulate DNA. We actually have the capacity to augment and strengthen certain aspects of natural systems. And then last, our work is to learn to live well with nature. An example, biofilms, which are structures that single bacteria build to create large structures. And in hospitals, they're very nasty. Biofilms cause lots of infection, cause a lot of problems. Anyway, a group researchers in Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania, have discovered that biofilms can be used to help stick sand together so that you can make stronger structures. Well, all of a sudden, we're talking about using a biological process to augment the building of of homes, perhaps in the poor areas of the world, where in fact all they can build with is with dirt and mud. And what they were saying about this is this may make them significantly earthquake resistant. That's nature tech. We find the biofilms, we apply it to a situation that we have, but really Mother Nature did the invention for us. We just discovered it.
Tell me about human tech.
Well, human tech is about us. It's the study of the technology that human beings have within us, within ourselves, from the marrow of our bones out to the edge of our skin. The science in that is the science of ourselves, and we haven't studied ourselves very much. A simple example of that is the placebo effect. It was always around. We really didn't understand it. We discounted it when we did medicines. Now it turns out that it looks like we can, in fact, convince ourselves to self-medicate in some situations and actually produce chemicals in our brain equivalent to the medicines we were going to take in the first place. So human technology is about all these amazing capacities we have built into us that we are only beginning to understand.
I know that you frequently get this question. It's obvious, but I'm going to ask it again. Why can't you just take the best technology from each region and make a hybrid?
It is the best question, and Scott and I pondered that long and hard, and we actually have two answers now. The simple answer is this. If you take a look at Mother Nature and look for hybrid ecosystems, you don't find them. Clearly, Mother Nature, who's been working on this for more than a billion years, has not hybridized ecosystems. So that's a cautionary thing, okay? The second reason is even more powerful. As you add a new element in a hybrid system, you have to understand its impact on everything else in that system if you're going to make a good decision. So that means human beings would have to spend a lot of time making these judgments before they add the new technology to the hybrid system. When you have a pure system, it's real simple to make the decision. That does fit limits or it doesn't fit limits. Okay, if it doesn't, we don't use it. That does fit local, it doesn't fit local. Okay, if it doesn't, we don't use it. Now, here's the last piece to that. I was just at the International Simulation and Gaming Association meeting to speak about five regions, and one of the simulation people raised their hand. He said, Mr. Barker, we have the solution. We just need to create a simulation of that hybrid society. We can run all the tests in simulation, and we can give you the hybrid society. So I'm now backing off and saying maybe the hybrid society is available, and maybe it will be our gaming people who provide the technology to allow us to make those kind of judgments.
Have you placed your bets on the ascendancy of any one of your five regions?
Well, here's Scott and I have placed a bet. We say all five of them are going to be around and more will be added because if you look at how Mother Nature's done it, she just has been adding more ecosystems. And so we expect to see Nature Tech split sometime in the next 10 years into two separate ecosystems. And we think Human Tech has the possibility of splitting into two separate technological ecosystems. So our bet is that there will be that these are going to continue to grow and flourish. And then just like complexity in the real world, we will continue to add more technological ecosystems as these systems interact and trigger new ways to deal with the world technologically.
Joel, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you for having me, Carol.
Joel Barker is co-author of Five Regions of the Future, Preparing Your Business for Tomorrow's Technology Revolution. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says we should use technological devices not to save time, but to spend our time more wisely.
Time-saving devices make life more efficient, but have the paradoxical effect of intensifying perceptions of a time famine. Daytimers and other time management tools impose a discipline that can make us feel trapped, even oppressed by our calendars. Every block of time is accounted for, so moving through the course of a day is like a ballet. The synchronized, calculated progression of steps belies the outward appearance of spontaneity and freedom of movement. Surely it is more than a coincidence that so many of us are now wearing digital watches that have a chronometer built right in. Cell phones, laptops, and personal digital assistants enable us to carry on with work outside of the office. Free time is no longer time away from work. Work has come to have a continual presence, giving many of us the feeling that our time off is more compressed as well as more suffused by the stresses and strains of work. We are particularly distressed when we think that our free time has been cheapened or depreciated. Leisure has a very high value in American society. Plus, with more prosperity, in some cases personal and in all cases societal, comes more interest in being able to indulge ourselves and have fun. Leisure has a strong pull on us, not just because of our personal needs for a break from work, but also because success is having the time and the autonomy to live at one's leisure. We want leisure to deliver on its promise of tranquility and fulfillment. In particular, we feel entitled to the luxury of leisure. This puts pressure on leisure time. If leisure time can't be enjoyed the way it is depicted in magazines, TV shows, and commercials, then we are likely to feel that it is wasted time. This urgent need for leisure time that measures up to the ideal adds to the impression that time is scarce and that good times are getting harder to find. Curiously, John Robinson of the University of Maryland and Jeffrey Godby of Penn State report in their research that since 1965, Americans have gained an average of about 1 hour of free time a day. What's declined is the gratification we get from our free time, not the amount of free time itself. What we are experiencing is a loss of equanimity. Whatever amount of free time we actually have, it is not enough. Everywhere we turn, we are under pressure to respond and perform. Whether working, playing, or shopping, it's all just one thing after another. There is more to do and more to choose from than ever before, so we are squeezing in more and more. More free time is not time off. If anything, it is more time available to do something else. Our challenge is spending our time better, not finding more time. And for that, we need a new perspective on time. One in which we measure our days by the quality of time spent, rather than the quantity of things on which we spend our time. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Our theme music was created and performed by Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.